The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to opening night of 2016, One Book, One Philadelphia. We are thrilled to raise the curtain on our 14th season, starring author Charles Frazier and featuring his deeply moving historical novel, Cold Mountain. Set at the end of the Civil War, Cold Mountain tells the heartrending story of Inman, a wounded Confederate soldier who walks away from the horrors of war to return home to his beloved Ada. His perilous journey through the war-ravaged landscape of North Carolina interweaves with Ada's struggles to maintain her father's farm as she waits for Inman to return. A compelling love story beats at the heart of the novel, propelling the action forward and keeping readers anxiously turning pages. Critics have praised Cold Mountain for its lyrical language, its reverential descriptions of the Southern landscape, and its powerful storytelling that dramatizes the utter devastation of war. Winner of the National Book Award, Cold Mountain has been recognized as a masterpiece, a miracle, one of the great accomplishments in American literature, an American odyssey. The novel is also the inspiration for Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Jennifer Higdon's opera, Cold Mountain, praised for its artistic aesthetic of the highest quality with a musical interpretation that hits you in the gut and vocal lines injected with the atmosphere of the setting, the psychology behind the character, and naturalistic inflections of the words being sung. Through her palette of sounds, shapes, colors, and scope, the composer tells a story unlike anyone else. Tonight, we are doubly honored by the presence of both author and composer, who in just a few minutes will discuss the intersection of literature and music in a conversation moderated by WHYY's Jennifer Lynn. But first, in a brief preview, some thoughts from our honorees. They don't expect this. So. So, praising the debut novel that inspired her first opera, Jennifer said, "The beauty of Mr. Frazier's story reminds all of us of our shared humanity and our lifetime journeys of the soul. His novel highlights those trials through adversity, hardship, friendship, and love. Though a story from the past, these lessons are all very much relevant today." And anticipating his present visit to Philadelphia, Charles recalled the small Main Street Carnegie Library of his boyhood. Quoting, "Even from the sidewalk, its architecture spoke to me of knowledge, of aspiration. I had to look up to see it, had to climb to enter it. Entering that little library was like entering a temple of books, and it rests in my memory, beautiful as the Medici Chapel." With that memory in mind, he looked forward to his February visit to Philadelphia and the opportunity of talking with readers and students about his work, about the joy of books, about the continued importance of libraries. And now, The Mountain and Charles Frazier have come to the Free Library of Philadelphia, our own temple of books, where we also look up and climb to enter. We are delighted to welcome Charles Frazier, to thank him for writing Cold Mountain and for his gracious participation in our program. We are also delighted to welcome Jennifer Higdon, to thank her for inviting One Book, One Philadelphia to participate in this joyful marriage of literature and opera, and for innovative and enthusiastic collaboration. Since its inception, One Book, One Philadelphia has become a favorite annual tradition, a positive literary, cultural, and civic force, bringing our diverse population together with a common focus and programs that deepen our understanding of our literary selections, ourselves, and our community. With Cold Mountain at its core, supplemented by two adult companion books to provide historic context and a personal account of the slave experience, our 2016 program will have the opportunity to explore the American Civil War with all of its complexities and ramifications. Philadelphia's own history is rooted in the Civil War as the birthplace of the abolitionist movement and a stop on the Underground Railroad. We invite you all to attend the many enriching and stimulating events, activities, and discussions found in our calendar of events, all designed to enhance your reading experience. I would like to express my deep appreciation to the devoted volunteers, talented library staff, creative community partners, and generous donors who have supported One Book for more than 14 years. You are the backbone of this amazing program. My heartfelt gratitude and admiration to my partner, Kalila Williams, gifted and masterful director of program who makes all things possible. And now, I am thrilled and honored to introduce our stars, Jennifer Higdon, one of America's most acclaimed and most frequently performed composers, composer of the soul-stirring opera Cold Mountain, and Charles Frazier, highly esteemed writer, winner of the National Book Award for Cold Mountain, and our 2016 One Book, One Philadelphia author.
So Jennifer and Charles were on the radio today on WHYY on Radio Times with Marty Moss Cawain. It was so inspirational, especially when Marty was able to play some snippets from Cold Mountain, the opera. It was so inspirational. I decided to interview these two in an operatic tone. But I realized I'd be really exhausted pretty quickly and drive you all insane, so I will spare you. Getting to the show here. Jennifer, this is your first opera. It took you about 3 years to create it.
Right.
And you've done so much in your career, but nothing of this magnitude, with this kind of dramatic structure. What were the biggest challenges?
Every day was a challenge. I have to say, when you are sitting down to figure out how to write music to honor characters, to tell a story in a different medium than was originally what was conceived for that story. So, but I have to admit, the ending was the hardest thing to actually compose. And I don't need a spoiler alert looking at the number of hands that went up in here, but I really had to screw up the courage. I thought, 2 years, I've been keeping Inman alive, and I've got to do what? It's so funny. It was like 4 days of weeping for me. Yeah. It literally was trying to see through the tears to do that. And even when we're in rehearsals, I have to admit, I'm sitting in there, I'm still getting weepy. Yeah. You'd think by now I would have adjusted, but it hasn't happened, so.
Well, composing, you're so esteemed in the realm of orchestral music and writing for individuals and even for voice, of course. But this involves the opera. It's such a complicated medium. It involves emotions, conflict, the stuff of people's experience.
It's completely different. I didn't know that when I started. I thought, this is like writing a piece of music. I thought it's going to be the same. I've written like 170 works. So I made the assumption that it was a matter of putting one note after another on a page, but it wasn't at all like that. The minute I started, the characters were looking over my shoulder, and it was very slow going in the first parts of writing, the first couple of months, trying to figure out what was the sound that belonged to each character, what would make them uniquely them. But the interesting thing is, by the time I got to the second act, it's a two-act opera, and I swear this is true, the characters were actually telling me what was supposed to be in the music. And there were times when I'd planned to do one thing, but the characters were insisting on another path. It was kind of a strange thing, and I decided to actually trust the characters. I went with what they were telling me. But the one thing I didn't count on is they live in your head the entire time. Which I started wondering if this is what authors go through, which it's a very different experience. In my dreams, they were there. The music was there. So,
yeah. Well, I want to get back to that, but I want to talk about just a couple of the devices really quickly that are things that are unique to opera, that can help carry the emotion and establish the characters and create the flow for the plot.
Right. Well, the first thing that's fantastic is having an orchestra at your disposal to back up the singers, because you can make really big sounds. And composers love to make really big sounds. That's the first thing we always think about, how can I make it loud? But the other thing is, you realize that you've got all those players in the orchestra and you can just have a couple people playing. So for me, I actually had like a drawing pad, and I realized when Gene Shear, my librettist, and I sat down and we tried to figure out what we were going to pull out. This could be the biggest opera you can imagine. It could be three nights. It could be the Ring Cycle. It's big enough. So much happens in the novel. But my rule was I wanted it to come in at 2.5 hours at the maximum, so we had to pull out individual sections. So there's a lot of daydreaming that goes on, and I was very adamant that I wanted a chorus. I thought, we may have one person singing, two people singing, a duet. We might have a trio, a quintet, but wouldn't it be really cool if we had a whole bunch of people singing? So that's the kind of thing you start thinking right off the bat. I had a big pad that I've like pulled out the things that Gene and I thought might be the relevant parts of the story, and I tried to plot out, because a good composer will find a way to tell the story that has constant variety. So we may start with one singer, but it's much better if you can alternate one singer, 40 singers, 5 singers, 2 singers. And so you have to kind of plan that out, but you also want to do it in a way that respects the order that the book goes in.
And speaking of voices over music, the voices are not amplified, so you have to be very careful the orchestra doesn't overpower.
That's the difference with opera. A lot of people don't often realize that. These singers, they have to learn to project the back of a 3,000-seat house. It's very different than a musical where people have microphones on.
And they can't even sing back-to-back nights, I understand. Yeah. Charles, oh, you're here. Oh, hi. I'm so sorry. I'm so rude sometimes. She used the T word, trust. You trusted Jennifer completely to do her best to honor your characters. What does the opera, which you saw performed in Santa Fe in August, best capture about your novel?
The thing about music, and the thing I'm so envious of musicians about, is music is such a direct conduit to the emotions. And all I can do is approximate that. The music I'm hearing as I'm writing these scenes and characters, creating tone in fiction is really hard, and in music, it's just there in this. As an audience member, it's not just there for you, but I was struck by that, just the way that music so fluidly and beautifully and sometimes powerfully and scarily captures those things that immediately that you struggle to get into words and never fully achieve.
We spoke a few weeks ago over the phone just to kind of break the ice a little bit. I spoke to you, Jennifer, as well. And Charles, I asked, what was your first impression of the opera? And I said, was it like watching, seeing life blown into Pinocchio? You know, like your characters are coming, the embodiment, they're moving and such.
Yeah, well, the first time I heard any of it was here in Philadelphia in 2010. Yeah. And I don't remember feeling this way, but Lenny Foglia, the director, said I looked stunned. I think if I was stunned, it was to hear Inman, who is so damaged and wounded that he can barely speak, sing in a huge, magnificent voice.
I love that you said that. And that... And how did he do? Did he really capture the spirit of the character in those vocals?
Yeah, the exhaustion, the determination, those kinds of characteristics were really strongly portrayed. I kept no preconceptions in my mind before I saw it to begin with, other than that I thought the set would have the corner of a barn and a tree and a piece of fence. And if those of you who are going to the opera, when you see the sets, there's not a corner of a barn and a fence and a tree.
It's a very modern setting. And I wanted to ask both of you, but Charles, you in particular, you know, painstakingly creating the imagery in the book. The landscape is so much a character and possesses the two characters to do the many things they do and learn the different things that they do. And then to see the limitations of a stage, you know, we can't see that beautiful landscape. And how does that make you feel?
Well, you've got the music, and one of the things to take some of that weight, but one of the things that I've been really interested in watching these characters, these situations, be turned into a movie and now an opera, is learning the different tools that the creators have. I remember one time talking with Anthony Minghella when he had maybe a second draft of a screenplay, and I was saying, you know, you've got all the violence, but there's a balance, and the balance feels off to me, in favor of the violence. And he said, you know, you always, as a novelist, have an option of correcting a problem through addition. He said, at this point, I do not have that option. Any corrections have to live within that time frame that is part of the structure of a movie. And and when you said 2.5 hours, yeah, it reminded me so much of his...
You have to be succinct when there's the limitation, yes, of a stage. And I also realized I had seen the movie, I think, 3 or 4 times when we decided to do this, and I realized we don't have the advantage of close-ups with the camera. You can't show the landscape. You can't show them doing something. So you have to imply as much as you can in the sound, hopefully subconsciously, so you don't overtly hear it. But it was an interesting challenge. This is not the kind of thing you tackle in a violin concerto at all. So,
well, that's what I want to ask. What does the South sound like?
Well, I have bluegrass. I have bluegrass in this opera. It's kind of funny. I'm an American composer, so my music is always labeled as American, and I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I thought, well, this is an American story, so maybe I can actually do this. But it's having grown up in the area close to Cold Mountain, I thought a lot about the bluegrass, how that affects, you know, I used to go up to Old Timers Day in Smoky Mountains, listen to them playing, fiddling, open strings on the violin, an emphasis on the offbeats. They would slide around because these weren't trained violinists. So I thought about those sorts of things when I was building kind of the musical palette. But I have a lot of sounds of the military in there because Inman is a soldier. So he often has a trumpet accompanying him or low brass, some sort of a brass sound. There are often war drums going. And so each one of the characters, I've kind of built a sound world. Ruby is always busy. I love Ruby. She's just making lists. She's got to take care of things. Her music is always moving at a real clip. She has a lot to get in her day. And so the music reflects that.
Did you want to chime in? Did you have something that came to mind? No?
Not on that.
Okay. All right. Now, if you read or sang aloud all of the novel, it would take you days to do so. So, Jennifer, you obviously had to pick scenes that would aid the story, and you made up the first scene, in fact. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, I think Jean and I were talking about it, and we realized...
Jean Shear is the librettist.
Right. We realized we needed to establish right off the bat one of the bad characters, someone from the Home Guard who is a main character in the book, Teague. Jean and I were looking for ways to shock people, basically, because I said, well, they're going to expect nice mountain music right off the bat, so what do we need to do? We looked at each other, and I said, we need to kill someone in the first couple of minutes. That was literally the conversation we had. I said, in the first couple of minutes, we need to kill someone. We need to show the bad guy right off the bat because it sets the story forward. But we had this unique challenge. Ada and Inman are separate. These two characters are separate through much of the opera. And Teague is a pretty bad guy, but he's not chasing Inman because Inman's walking home. But we needed the audience to know that there was a bad guy on the loose. Basically, so that gives you a little bit of tension in the story to kind of work against, but nothing gets you going. And I'm always aware an audience is sitting there in a concert. I think about their adrenaline level, how they respond. So I thought, all right, if we kill the guy right off the bat, you're going to know this is not a nice guy. And it's very simple storytelling. But because I was saying 2.5 hours, not over 2.5 hours, we had to get there fast. We needed to establish who was like what immediately because. Most people don't know this. It takes 3 times longer to sing a line than it does to say a line. So if you were just reading the book, it would be a totally different speed than if they're actually singing it. So you have to be very concise and right to the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that's so easy in writing fiction is movement through time. A novel is very fluid. A movie and an opera, it's happening in front of you. Visually, it wants to move forward, and novels enjoy looping back and shifting. So there's something in the very form that makes you not able to go back sometimes.
Right.
So when I was dealing with two characters that spend a love story, where the two characters spend 80-90% of the book apart. I can just flow back, and drift in and out of time. But I remember talking with Gene about it when he first came to Asheville to talk, and he said, that's one of the problems, and I'm coming up with some solutions, but we need them to sing together, and they're not together.
So interesting. Yeah. Now, you may have noticed that Jennifer and Charles have a similar accent. Maybe Jennifer's a little on no-dos, and Charles is kind of down on sedatives. No. They're from the same region of the country. And, you know, that familiarity with the South, Jennifer, how did this help you with composing the opera?
Well, you know, it's really stuck out. I was looking for stories, but the minute I started this novel, I was like, this is the one. I actually searched for a story for, I think it was 5 years. It was 4 or 5 years of looking for the right one because opera is new to me, and I figured I need to start in a familiar territory. But having grown up just on the other side of the Smokies from where the actual Coal Mountain is, it seemed perfect. And I knew it within the first, like, 3 or 4 pages.
That's interesting. And Charles, at the opera, at which you went to in Santa Fe, so you've heard this version, and also leading up with the different practices, you've heard different renditions of the opera, Cold Mountain. You know, while you're sitting having the operatic experience, you hear audience reaction. They gasp. You know, they chuckle. They weep. What's it like to have that real-time gathering, gleaning of what the audience is thinking about, basically your story?
Well, I mean, it is very odd because you you know, you're sitting in a room by yourself in your sweatpants and t-shirt for years at a time, you know, and you can't trust your own reaction. Even if you try to be really hard-nosed, you think, God, this is pretty funny right here. This is you don't have that, and it would be wonderful to, must be wonderful,
yeah,
to have that. I was in Berkeley doing a bookstore thing, and the woman at the bookstore said, I want to read you something. And she read the first page of my third book, Nightwoods, and she said, now that's supposed to be funny, isn't it?
No. Oh, boy.
And I said, well, it's supposed to be deadpan funny. And she said, I thought it was. So that's about as much, you know, kind of immediate reaction as a novelist gets.
And Charles, you say you've been rather fortunate in the way of being on different speaking panels and so forth with other authors talking about the creative process. And your book, of course, has been adapted to film and now the opera. And maybe you can explain what I'm getting at. You said you've been so fortunate, but you've been with other people who are like, whoa, we had this terrible experience and this terrible, and you're like, nope, it was pretty excellent for me.
Yeah, I was on a panel discussion last spring with six or eight other writers who had movies made from their books, and they went, you know, around the table and told horror stories about, oh, they treated me so poorly, oh, I wasn't even allowed on the set, oh, my book set in the Southern Appalachians had a grizzly bear in it, you know, those kinds of things. And then it was my turn, and I was like, it was an incredible, educational, lovely experience that I learned a lot about narrative from, and it was sort of like, oh, well, was the reaction.
And you've walked in the woods with Gene Shear and Jennifer as well to share the flavors that you want to share with these other creators.
We've been together over the years.
You know, it's kind of funny. I was afraid to go down to Coal Mountain. I had started writing the first act before we had actually met. But because we both have hiked on the exact same mountains, it was like we were there, but I knew it would be too emotional for me to go visit the graves of the individuals. I actually really thought, oh, I don't know if I can actually do this. I'm going to have to wait until after the opera goes up, because when I was in the process of writing, I didn't want to make it so emotional that I couldn't function, think clearly, think about what the audience is going to hear, what the performers are going to go through. So I refrained from going down to Asheville, and I let Gene do it all.
We'll should go sometime to the cemetery where Inman is probably.
I'll have to take a box of Kleenex if I do. Kleenex. This is definitely going to be a Kleenex event.
It's an unmarked grave, and when you mentioned that maybe I'll revise the ending.
Would you please?
When the book was bought, it was not finished. I had and I had nothing written on the ending. The last maybe 20% of the book, 25% of the book. So the first conversation with the publisher and the editor, they were, oh, we're so happy that we're going to do a good job. And then they said, so how does it end? And I said, I don't know how the book ends yet, but I do know how the real story ended. He was shot and killed in a gunfight when he came back home. And there was this, like, long pause. And then the three people on the other end of this conference call at the same time said, no. But to their credit, they never put any pressure on me to actually do that.
Jennifer, you've told me that there is music playing in your head constantly. Like, for instance, what are you listening to right now?
Coal Mountain. Oh, it's not going away right now. I mean, it's really, this is going to sound funny because we're rehearsing so much. It is constant. The minute I wake up, it's playing. Sometimes it's in my dreams. So I'm actually having to go to sleep with earbuds in listening to rock and roll. It's the only way I can get it to
talk about an earworm, right?
Yeah.
But music has that much presence in your life. Let us know what your day is like. You're making music every day, correct?
Right. My goal is always to compose every single day, if I can. And it's a balancing act because sometimes you have public events, sometimes you're traveling to an orchestra, you're going to do a residency at a university. But for me, a happy day is to sit down in the morning, write all the way 3 or 4 hours, go have lunch, sit back down after lunch, write.
On piano and computer?
Both, okay. Yeah, both. And write a couple more hours. And if it's been a good day of writing, writing the opera was heaven. Can I just say, because this was the primary excuse for not traveling, I got to stay in Philly for a really long period of time. It was fantastic. And I was in heaven. But at the end of the writing day, because I was writing 7 or 8 hours, there was nothing left in my head. I mean, people said, oh, you look like you're walking around the city. You're not aware. And I would say, huh? But it was great. There was something about exercising the mind and exercising the soul like that and getting to do it every day that to me was just the most extraordinary expense. And also living in that world, you know?
Yeah.
Before the opera, I was writing between 6 and 12 pieces a year. So that's shifting quite a bit through a lot of different worlds. But to sit down and spend that much time in one world was quite heavenly.
And Charles, to be fair, are you always holding on to a thought that might be useful in your writing, like she keeps music in her head?
Yeah. When I'm writing, I write all every day, so 7 days a week. It's very hard for me to take a day off because then there's this cost of taking a break. When I'm not writing, I'm not writing. So I take long breaks between projects, but when I am writing, it needs to be every day just to keep that flow of those thoughts coming and to keep those characters stuck in your head.
And I guess I'm asking you to be a little meta on this final question. We're going to take some questions from the audience in just a second. Charles, why does your book, Cold Mountain, have so much longevity to be a one book, one Philadelphia selection, 20 years after it was published, to become the premise of an opera?
What? What'd I say? That's a hard question.
No, it's one of those questions that, I don't know, I mean, I can say it's got some very old forms of narrative embedded in it, the journey narrative that goes back to the very beginning of story, that kind of thing. But really, I can't answer the question. I think if people could answer that question, they could do it. You know,
Well, thank you for trying. We are going to open it up to the floor, and I'll assume that there are some folks in the queue who would like to ask Jennifer Higdon and Charles Frazier.
I see microphones coming down the aisle.
I see microphones.
Mr. Frazier, I loved your book. I was very, very moved at the ending of the book. One of the things that interested me very much is you write in the vernacular of that time. And as an author, you were using another language almost.
Well, I grew up in a very small town in far western North Carolina. So when I was a kid, there were still people plowing their fields with mules and doing, you know, the older people like my grandparents were doing things the old way. My grandparents' farm, other than having electricity, could have been 1865. There was not an internal combustion engine on their entire farm. They grew up. My grandfather was born in 1878 or 9, and their language was that old Southern Appalachian language, and I knew a lot of other older people of that sort. So a lot of getting the language of Cold Mountain was accessing my memory of their language. I could tell I was going to have a good day when I could kind of hear my grandmother's voice in my ear when I started working, because she had she had a really pure Southern Appalachian voice. Some of it is the names of things, names of kitchen implements, names of farm implements. Some of those I had, that's research. And I made a rule at the start that I would not stop and explain what those were, that I wouldn't say a spurtle, a kitchen implement used for stirring larger pots. And I thought it would be a bloody battle with an editor, and it wasn't in the least.
Also on language, Mr. Fraser, you contributed so much to my vocabulary. I knew what always known what a mule is, but I never knew what a henny is. Yeah. And you might want to tell us. But
it
on
wasn't
your
a belly button.
But on your characters, you captured me with your characters from the despicable Junior to the loving Sarah with her 18-month-old infant and a pig. Where did you find those characters?
Well, some of those are from local history. The Sarah with the cabin and the pig and the dead husband is an old story that may have a kernel of truth in it from a county in western North Carolina, Madison County, that people still refer to sometimes as Bloody Madison because of its violent history going back to the Civil War. So I used the kernel of that story and then built a role for Inman in it. Some of them were stories. One of my grandfathers was a really good storyteller, and he had a little cabin at the foot of Cold Mountain, and it was a hunting cabin with an outhouse out back, no electricity, fireplace, and he loved to take the grandchildren up there for the weekend and build a fire, and we'd sit around and he'd tell ghost stories and that sort of thing. So if I can get a feeling of my grandfather telling stories in some of those pieces, I feel content with what I've done.
I could Google it, but I'd rather hear you tell it. What is the real story of Inman?
Well, the real story of Inman, and this is something that when... as I was trying to find a story to write a novel about, my father had retired recently and was telling me, oh, here's some things I'm finding. And he told me this story, and it was just a little paragraph of this. There were four brothers. One of them was my great-great-great-grandfather. Four brothers went off to the Civil War. None of them owned slaves. None of them were ever going to have money if they wanted to own slaves to do it. And I was always curious what their stake in that war was. They had horrible, horrible experiences. Two of them died. Two of them came home damaged by the war for the rest of their lives. But this journey, the walking home, deserting the army, disillusioned with the war you had fought for 4 years, stuck with me. And even just driving back to Raleigh from western North Carolina after he told me that story, it was just going in my mind. I know how to tell this story. I know how to tell that walk. And it was going to be a very short book, a very violent, vicious, ugly book, with an ending utterly devoid of hope. And
you can applaud. He's deserving applause.
And then Ada and Ruby popped into the book, and it became a totally different book, and I'm forever grateful to them for showing up.
Me too.
Mr. Fraser, again, Ms. Lynn mentioned the longevity of the novel, and it made me think about, I wondered if any of our recent war returnees, current veterans, had caught up with you and expressed connections to their own experience of homecoming and the story that you tell.
I haven't so much from our most recent wars, but I have talked to a lot of veterans of the wars of my lifetime and the wars of my father's lifetime over the years who have talked about the things in that book that resonated emotionally with them.
Mr. Fraser, you come from that area. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your experiences of actually working, doing the chores on the farm, on the type of farm that is depicted, and also your experiences of hiking or wandering through the mountains there.
All right. Yeah. Well, as I said, my grandparents had a farm. I think it was about 35, 40 acres, and off of that little mountain subsistence farm, they sent four kids to college. They had a house full of books, no indoor plumbing, but a house full of books. They had one of those old pump organs with the stops, yes, and yeah. They had one of those and played. I remember my father talking about my aunt playing. It was something from Dvorak on that. Mm-hmm.
That it was New World Symphony. It was the theme from that, actually. Yeah. Sets a pocket
consultant in the house. And, so good to have for everybody.
This little farm isolated in the mountains with this little bright light of culture in it. And it was hard work. I mean, it was a lot of brutal work. I did some of that growing up. I did... like in high school, the idea of working in a store or something like that, I didn't want to do. So in the summertime, I would get a job on a farm. And so I did tobacco work, tomatoes, any kind of agricultural work where I'd be outside all day doing something physical.
Tobacco work is hard.
Yes. Tobacco work is nasty.
You know, most people don't know this, but I had to work. My dad was an artist. We had a 40-acre farm. This may be why the story resonated, but I can remember doing chores, the collecting of the eggs and helping sometimes when the cows got out. They would climb to, we didn't have a dairy, but there was a dairy next door. And so trying to get the cows back in with the barbed wire came down. Was an ordeal, but it's pretty amazing when you're working, you're sent out to I would say work crops. That sounds funny. I'm saying that, but you work out on the tomatoes and all. But I know the tobacco. Watching the tobacco farming around us was extraordinarily hot and difficult work. Mm. It was enough to make you want to get an education.
Yes.
And it's ironic. Yes. The school I went to in Blount County tonight, I actually received an award from the county where I went to high school. And I told them I needed to be here, and it was, they don't know what a Pulitzer Prize is there in Blount County. So the newspaper in the area is actually written at a sixth grade level. And so the high school I went to was they took a bunch of small country schools and consolidated it. And it's kind of amazing. My classmates, there were 430 of us, but 30 of us went to college. And it makes you realize how important reading and education will affect your life tremendously. And I keep up with my classmates, and they think my world is just very surreal for them, but it makes me so appreciate, especially programs like this and your experiences, how important books are. They are our world. There wouldn't be music without the books in reality.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah. The library in the little town where I grew up was the culture of that little town. That and the little Main Street movie theater, that was pretty much it. I haunted the library.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to steal a line from Marie earlier. She mentioned Journey of the Soul to describe the story called Mountain, and I think we've learned a bit about your own journey of your soul and yours as well in your relationships to this story. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for participating in this One Book, One Philadelphia event. Keep in mind, as Marie mentioned earlier, there are many, many other events associated with One Book, One Philadelphia going on now through the end of March. Thank you so much.
So one of the next part of this, and that was a fabulous conversation, and I want to thank Jennifer Lynn for doing such a great job in this interview with Jennifer and Charles. So now we are thrilled that our one book season will coincide with the East Coast premiere of the opera Cold Mountain, as you just heard, at Opera Philadelphia. This is a unique opportunity for two treasured Philadelphia institutions to collaborate and to extend the discussion of this powerful story. And so here now, to give us a sneak peek of this powerful new opera, is David B. Devan, General Director and President of Opera Philadelphia, who will introduce tonight's performances. David.
Thank you, Siobhan. We're just so thrilled to be in partnership with the Free Library. One Book, One Philadelphia is a massive and wonderful civic happening that engages us as citizens in a dialogue and in literature and reading and being a part together. And that is one of the things that I personally love most about Philadelphia, the one degree of separation that we can come together and make things happen. And we've talked today about taking Charles' book and turning it into an opera. And we all, everyone in this room, whether you knew it or not, was a part of this happening because this opera was forged in Philadelphia. It was written in your studio. It was forged in this city. Because another great partnership is with the Curtis Institute of Music, one of the great music training institutions on the planet Earth. And all the workshops were done there. And we were able to bring everything, these characters, this story, into our presence and support Jennifer in writing it. So this is an opera that we all own, and it's just been a pleasure for us all to develop it. And we have some people to sing it with us today, also from Curtis. So Jonathan McCullough is doing his final master's degree at Curtis, and he will be singing Inman tonight. He was with Opera Philadelphia in our 2014 new production of Barber of Seville, and he will be joined by Rachel Sternberg, who is covering Ada, and she did all the workshops. It's the first time we heard Ada was through Rachel's voice, and she also in the opera has the baby and the hog, Sarah. And they are joined by Lisa Keller, who is our two-fisted orchestra. There are actually 60 musicians in the opera. Lisa was also the repetiteur that was a partner with Jennifer in developing this piece. And they're going to, Jonathan's going to sing Inman's aria, Metal Age. Thank you, Jennifer. It's in her head. This happens in the opera after Inman has just been asked a question from the blind man about, how great it is that he can see, and Inman tells him that he's seen some things he really wished he hadn't. And then we're also going to hear the Orion aria, which is one of those moldings of space and time that had to happen to bring Inman and Ada together so that they could sing together. And so with that, I'll ask our artists to come and join us, and I hope you enjoy this part of the program. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you. general exclaim. They'll fall like rain dripping down from the eaves of a house. No, there was nothing poetic, nothing as pure as a drop of water. Stench. And there, in the middle of it, a drum boy crying, bleeding, dying. Let me help you, boy. Let me help. Afraid even of kindness. He shot me in the night. The night has come. With the cross of red clenched in my fist, drenched with blood.
will have Renee Orth, a composer originally from Dallas, Texas, who will tell a fucking piece of Miniatures from the Mountain, a violin solo she composed for the 2016 One Book, One Philadelphia kickoff, based on the featured selection of Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier. Renee Orth currently holds the Edward B. Garrigues Fellowship at the Curtis Institute of Music. She earned a Master's in Music Composition at the University of Louisville as a Moritz von Baumhard Fellow and holds degrees from Media Tech Institute and Rhodes College. Renee.
Hi, everyone. It's such an honor and a privilege to stand here before all of you today and alongside these amazing artists and to share some new music with you tonight. When I received this commission, I was slightly overwhelmed because, you know, it's supposed to be a 7-8 minute piece, and there's a wealth of things from the book that I could draw inspiration from. I noticed as I started reading through that there was fiddle tunes that were named, and I started to look. I started making a list of them, and I Googled them, and I realized that they're actual fiddle tunes, and started listening to them. And I thought to myself, well, wouldn't this be kind of fun to write a few miniatures, merging these fiddle tunes with some classical techniques together? And I'll have to see if my favorite collaborator is available. And luckily, she was. So we had a lot of fun putting this together. And so this is a small tribute to the composer in the book, Stobrod. With that being said, I'd like to introduce the performer tonight, Abby Fayette, a good friend of mine. She's in her fourth year of studies at the Curtis Institute of Music, currently studying with Ida Kavafian. She's an amazing collaborator, amazing friend, currently sitting as a concertmaster of Curtis Institute Symphony Orchestra. Please join me in welcoming her to the stage.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.